Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains a lot of very graphic descriptions of some extremely disturbing content, which even if you weren't someone who has an experience with previous trauma that's relating to these factors, it's disturbing content full stop. There's, of course, the usual warning for death, the usual warning for military absolute disregard for the sacredness of life, etc., etc., and incredible greed, like absolutely unfettered greed and self-serving nature of individuals and attitudes. But also, there is sexual assault multiple times. There is violence against children, like physical nasty violence. There is descriptions of extreme cases of injustice and violence, and a very bleak kind of view on some aspects of humanity. A horrible, like a horrific concept of children being treated as a commodity, and like it's pretty bad, and a lot of gaslighting and manipulation, but that's nothing compared to some of the more atrocious descriptions.
And let me just chime in, this chapter contains both Milo and Arfi.
Yeah, and there was straight up murder.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Please join us as we continue with Catch-22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 39, The Eternal City.
And yes, we had a bit of speculation what that title's about. And I reckon it's the Vatican, but I don't know.
It's about a what?
I don't know. The Vatican, maybe?
Oh, the Vatican. Yeah. Could be about the Vatican. And, it could be about the mind palace you see in your dreams.
Could be the whole Rome thing, the idea that Rome's been around for a couple of empires. The rise and fall of many empires.
That would link in with the old man.
Yes, it would.
And I went to Dream Palace because, for some reason, I keep thinking of it as the Eternal Palace instead of the Eternal City. I don't know why.
It's a thing.
Maybe it's the day as well.
Yeah.
It's a lazy afternoon. If you can't tell from the audio recording, we're no longer in the same place. That was a one-off for a while from last week.
Yes.
It was fun.
So hopefully soonish we will be able to continue again. But yes.
Cohabitate on the podcast.
Yeah. Co-present whilst in the same vicinity. That would be good. But yes, in the meantime, we are back to the huge. And there's been a storm warning, but not for us. But it's within the quadrant of the state, I want to say.
That's a big quadrant.
It's a big quadrant. I mean, in relation to the larger scale of our state, it's not actually that big a quadrant, but yeah. So just if we suddenly have any drop in our quality, this may be related to that.
And not the ramshackle internet infrastructure we have in our country.
Not at all. Not at all to do with the fact that we never.
If you want to start a ranch, just talk to someone in Australia in our age group about what they think about the NBN and the rollout.
Oh, so bad. The worst thing is I feel so bad for anyone who's rural because they've been dependent on satellite internet for the longest time. Probably why we didn't have as much pushback against 5G as we've had in many other countries. We have one corner in Australia that's a bit like, oh, 5G. Oh, we don't like that. The birds, you know, they're trying to control our brains. But there's literally only one area that has that kind of approach. Because everywhere else is just like, wait, I might actually have decent reception and internet speeds. Bring it on. In the meantime, it's kind of restricted to only certain cities and certain pockets in certain cities, and it's not actually that all-embracing just yet. But yeah.
We got a while. And considering how things move in this country, probably more than we think.
Yeah. By the time 5G is rolled out in Australia, everyone will be up to 10G. You know. We're getting there, but...
Mm. Yeah, I saw it was a Reddit video of like a what's it called when time moves very fast on camera?
Yeah. Time lapse? No?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And it was a Danish highway ripping up a road and inserting a tunnel in an entire weekend and having the road be normal by the time Monday morning hit. And,
wow.
Yeah, all the comments were just like, you know, mostly it was folks from the U.S., but there were people in England, and, you know, everyone was like, yeah, over here that would take 20 years.
Yeah, we have some slight efficiency issues. But, I mean, Australia has the added bonus of really unpredictable weather challenges that make things more complicated. Like, I mean, our roads start getting melty. In summer, yeah, so
every time it rains, there are new potholes everywhere.
Yes, it's unavoidable, and it's not like they can switch over to other materials that easily, because we've discussed this much earlier in the podcast. Concrete isn't an option because I know in Europe they will use some modified forms of concrete for certain stretches of highway, but if it gets too cold there as well, it'll crack. Here, because of the extreme rain when it does happen. When we do have torrential rain, plus extreme heat.
Yeah.
That is not the combination you want, my friends. Not for concrete.
Yeah.
So even modified concrete doesn't work that well. Well, in terms of maintenance, it's just, it's cost sink. But yeah, we have, look, I think it's there is an irony in being in a time zone that's ahead of most of the rest of the world, whilst technologically, infrastructure-wise, being slightly behind in many ways, in terms of the quote-unquote, the OSED nations that Australia tries to compare itself to. Yeah, look, we just have to work with what we've got. I think there's a little bit of... We need to encourage innovation a lot more, and whatever that might look like, we need to have a lot more innovation when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to, is it really necessary to, should it be necessary to commute, I don't know, hours to work?
God.
Or should, no. And I mean, especially in this age of understanding, if we have the appropriate infrastructure in place to allow us to do a lot more remote work, we would rely on less commuting, which would, again, drop down our... in terms of ecological impact, in terms of this, many ways we could make a huge difference in terms of lifestyle, let alone the wear and tear that our infrastructure goes through. I don't know. There's a lot that could be done. And I think it's going to take, my favorite phrase to say is going to take a few generations. Yes. But that doesn't mean that we stay complacent in our, what we can do to contribute to it as well. Like, we do what we can do. And encourage others to try their best without berating, without like instructing, you must do this way because. No. If you see there's challenges in the world and you feel like they're pretty insurmountable, it feels really big, focus on, this is, I guess, a theme of our podcast, focus on the little thing that you can do. Be this, I don't know, offering your umbrella to someone. You know, if you've got a coat, and you're cold, like it's cooler weather coming, and you've got a second coat, and you can give it away to someone who maybe needs it, and you've got to, you know, do that. If that's in your, if that's the way you want to contribute to the world, do what you can do. I think everything counts. Whatever we do counts.
And speaking of what you can do, it looks like going back to the book. This is a very tortured segue. Looks like Yossarian's been. Put into a leadership position, so.
Well, there's that, and also Yossarian, this is why I'm saying Yossarian's trying to do something that he can do, because immediately, as soon as he heard about the kid, this is actually why I brought up, the kid's like all alone, she doesn't know anyone else in the city, what's going to happen to her? Why do I care? And that way, that callous treatment of people who might be vulnerable, and that's really... That Yossarian, despite the kind of person that he has been, and he hasn't been the most selfless person. No one's saying he's an angel. by any stretch of the imagination. But it's interesting that he's standing out now because he's refused. He's had enough.
Mm.
And everyone's and then he hears things like that kid's just been kind of dumped on the road and they don't really care.
And here's another interesting thing. It kind of goes to show you that it's always the folks that are actually doing all the work that really have the power, because him refusing, they want to punish him, all his superiors, but they can't. I mean,
no.
Eventually they will obviously find a way, even if they have to disappear him. But, you know, yeah. He's, for all intents and purposes, a war hero. He's this star of their company because he went over Ferrara. Was it Ferrara?
Yeah. And
two times. Just,
I have a feeling that might have been their only true victory.
Probably, yeah.
I think that everything else has been muddy or claimed by someone else. Or, for example, when it was meant to be a milk run and it wasn't and they lost a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think they lost a lot of people constantly and it's made them look bad.
Well, yeah, because they're all incompetent.
Yeah. And it's the one time that they actually got the job done, despite it taking an effort that was not actually sanctioned.
Hmm. And of course, he got yelled at for it.
Yeah.
He got yelled at for their victory.
He got yelled at for doing something that they didn't authorize or ask him to do.
Well,
because made them look incompetent that they couldn't get it done the first time round. But it's war. It's combat.
It's that thing where often you hear stories of people getting work done, but they didn't get it done in the right way, so they get chastised for it. And it's like, as long as it gets done and it's done well, why does it matter? But sadly, to a lot of folks, the way it's done does matter.
But also, I mean, this is the issue. It's like, I think in this case, their concept of what is a necessary military maneuver is anything that they have sanctioned and instructed should be done versus actually, you know, having some reliance on the competence of the people who are doing, who are actually in the field, who are experiencing what is going on. But I mean, if the entire Air Force was made up of ARFIs and if it was all ARFIs and DODs, I can understand why.
What a novel concept, right? Trusting the folks to do what they've been trained to do.
Or at least getting the information from the people firsthand who are flying these missions. Like, they'd flown Ferrara a few times, and they were saying, we need to get this bridge done, and the only way we're going to get it done is if, like, it needs to get done. We won't survive another round, right? And they're not listening to the men telling them this. And that's, I guess, a big part of the problem. Whenever the men are sharing something with them, such as the chaplain, such as, like, this is a problem, that their morale is dropping and their ability to continue doing this, you're going to end up with a lot of losses if you don't do something quickly, if you don't stop with this missions nonsense. They don't listen to them and they say what they've said, and they haven't said what they say they've said. You know, it's a mess.
But you know, Yossarian being broken was only the back half of the chapter. The front half, well, he was in, it's like, he's now in, what would you call it? Not metaphysical danger, but he's like, he's got a threat looming over him. In the first half of the chapter, the threat was physical, right there. He was, a lady from Rome was going to murder him.
Yeah, Natalie's was trying to kill him. And at the same time, what's the deal? Now, we don't know whether it's now he's being threatened by the specters of his guilt or the sort of Damocles kind of situation where he doesn't know what the punishment is, but he knows the punishment is coming.
Mm. Or, you know, that the theory you raised that maybe she was paid off to end him. And the fact that she failed is why the whole building's been evacuated.
Yeah. So Eternal City will be interesting. It's, yeah. And the fact that Captain Black is, it's Captain Black's weird. I'm wondering if he actually is, he avoided him, even Arfi group keeps getting threats, keeps walking backwards with the gun. Captain Black's weird. And then this whole attitude of, hey, if this would have made you unhappy, I should have told you this earlier.
Well, yeah, he seems that he is one of those people whose only, well, his main form of pleasure is derived by making other people miserable.
Yes, he's one of those people where the suffering of others brings him joy. Ah, sadists.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually the term for them, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Why don't we check out the Eternal City now? And we'll see if Captain Black is in it. We'll see if the Assyrian's in it.
I don't see Captain Black as entering the Eternal City. That was a terrible joke. Theophilosophical.
Chapter 39, The Eternal City. Yessarian was going absent without official leave with Milo, who, as the plane cruised towards Rome, shook his head reproachfully and, with pious lips pursed, informed Yessarian in ecclesiastical tones that he was ashamed of him. Yessarian nodded. Yessarian was making an uncouth spectacle of himself by walking around backward with his gun on his hip and refusing to fly more combat missions, Milo said. Yessarian nodded. It was disloyal to his squadron and embarrassing to his superiors. He was placing Milo in a very uncomfortable position, too. Yessarian nodded again. The men were starting to grumble. It was not fair for Yessarian to think only of his own safety while men like Milo, Colonel Cathcart, Colonel Korn, and ex-PFC Wintergreen were willing to do everything they could to win the war. The men with 70 missions were starting to grumble because they had to fly 80, and there was a danger some of them might put on guns and begin walking around backward, too. Morale was deteriorating, and it was all Yessarian's fault. The country was in peril. He was jeopardizing his traditional rights of freedom and independence by daring to exercise them.
God, I loathe Milo. I loathe Milo more than Arfi, I think.
But it's close.
Yeah.
Yessarian kept nodding in the co-pilot seat and tried not to listen as Milo prattled on. Nately's was on his mind, as were Kraft and Orr and Nately and Dunbar, and Kid Samson and Nick Watt, and all the poor and stupid and diseased people he had seen in Italy, Egypt, and North Africa, and knew about in other areas of the world, and Snowden and Nately's kid sister were on his conscience too. Yessarian thought he knew why Nately's held him responsible for Nately's death and wanted to kill him. Why the hell shouldn't she? It was a man's world, and she and everyone younger had every right to blame him and everyone older for every unnatural tragedy that befell them, just as she, even in her grief, was to blame for every man-made misery that landed on her kid sister and on all other children behind her. Someone had to do something sometime. Every victim was a culprit, every culprit a victim, and somebody had to stand up sometime to try to break the lousy chain of inherited habit that was imperiling them all. In parts of Africa, little boys were still stolen away by adult slave traders and sold for money to men who disemboweled them and ate them. Yessarian marveled that children could suffer such barbaric sacrifice without evincing the slightest hint of fear or pain. He took it for granted that they did submit so stoically. If not, he reasoned, the custom would certainly have died, for no craving for wealth or immortality could be so great, he felt, as to subsist on the sorrow of children.
Let's just pause there for a second.
Hmm?
This is going to be needing a warning. But that sentence there, he can't cope with the idea, like within his moral framework of reasoning,
yeah.
He can't see that anyone would justify. In the meantime, he was set on a mission to bomb a village.
Yeah.
You know?
Hmm.
And he can't cope with it. He can't cope with this death anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's also senseless as well.
Yeah, it's the senselessness of it all, but also, Oof, okay.
He was rocking the boat, Milo said, and Yessarian nodded once more. He was not a good member of the team, Milo said. Yessarian nodded and listened to Milo tell him that the decent thing to do if he did not like the way Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn were running the group was go to Russia instead of stirring up trouble. Yessarian refrained from pointing out that Colonel Cathcart, Colonel Korn, and Milo could all go to Russia if they did not like the way he was stirring up trouble. Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn had both been very good to Ysarion, Myla said. Hadn't they given him a medal after the last mission to Ferreira and promoted him to captain? Ysarion nodded. Didn't they feed him and give him his pay every month? Ysarion nodded again. Myla was sure that they would be charitable if he went to them to apologize and recant and promise to fly 80 missions. Ysarion said he would think it over, and held his breath and prayed for a safe landing as Myla dropped his wheels and glided in toward the runway. It was funny how he had really come to detest flying. Rome was in ruins, he saw when the plane was down. The aerodrome had been bombed 8 months before, and knobby slabs of white stone rubble had been bulldozed into flat-topped heaps on both sides of the entrance through the wire fence surrounding the field. The Colosseum was a dilapidated shell, and the Arch of Constantine had fallen. Natalie's apartment was a shambles. The girls were gone, and the only one there was the old woman. The windows in the apartment had been smashed. She was bundled up in sweaters and skirts and wore a dark shawl about her head. She sat on a wooden chair near an electric hot plate, her arms folded, boiling water in a battered aluminum pot. She was talking aloud to herself when Ysarion entered and began moaning as soon as she saw him. "Gone!" she moaned before he could even inquire. Holding her elbows, she rocked back and forth mournfully on her creaking chair. "Gone. Who?" All the poor young girls.
Where?
Away! Chased away into the street. All of them gone. All the poor young girls.
Chased away by who? Who did it?
The mean tall soldiers with the hard white hats and clubs. And by our carabinieri. They came with their clubs and chased them away. They would not even let them take their coats. The poor things. They just chased them away into the cold.
Did they arrest them?
They chased them away. They just chased them away.
Then why did they do it if they didn't arrest them?
I don't know, sobbed the old woman. I don't know. Who will take care of me? Who will take care of me now that all the poor young girls are gone? Who will take care of me?
There must have been a reason, Ysarion persisted, pounding his fist into his hand. They couldn't just barge in here and chase everyone out.
No reason, wailed the old woman. No reason. What right did they have?
Catch 22.
What?
Ysarion froze in his tracks with fear and alarm, and felt his whole body begin to tingle.
What did you say?
Catch 22, the old woman repeated, rocking her head up and down. Catch 22. Catch 22 says they have a right to do anything we can't stop them from doing.
What the hell are you talking about? Ysarion shouted at her in bewildered, furious protest. How did you know it was Catch 22? Who the hell told you it was Catch 22?
The soldiers with the hard white hats and clubs. The girls were crying. Did we do anything wrong? They said.
The men said no, and pushed them away out the door with the ends of their clubs.
Then why are you chasing us out? The girl said.
Catch 22, the men said.
What right do you have? The girl said.
Catch 22, the men said.
All they kept saying was Catch 22, Catch 22. What does it mean, Catch 22? What is Catch 22?
Didn't they show it to you? Ysarion demanded, stamping about in anger and distress. Didn't you even make them read it?
They don't have to show us Catch 22, the old woman answered. The law says they don't have to.
What law says they don't have to?
Catch 22.
Oh, god damn, Ysarion exclaimed bitterly. I bet it wasn't even really there.
He stopped walking and glanced about the room disconsolately.
Where is the old man?
Gone, mourned the old woman.
Gone?
Dead, the old woman told him, nodding in emphatic lament, pointing to her head with the flat of her hand.
Something broke in here. 1 minute he was living, 1 minute he was dead.
But he can't be dead, Ysarion cried, ready to argue incessantly.
But of course he knew it was true, knew it was logical and true. Once again, the old man had marched along with the majority. Ysarion turned away and trudged through the apartment with a gloomy scowl, peering with pessimistic curiosity into all the rooms. Everything made of glass had been smashed by the men with the clubs. Torn drapes and bedding lay dumped on the floor. Chairs, tables, and dressers had been overturned. Everything breakable had been broken. The destruction was total. No wild vandals could have been more thorough. Every window was smashed, and darkness poured like inky clouds into each room through the shattered panes. Ysarion could imagine the heavy, crashing footfalls of the tall MPs in the hard white hats. He could picture the fiery and malicious exhilaration with which they had made their wreckage, and their sanctimonious, ruthless sense of right and dedication. All the poor young girls were gone. Everyone was gone but the weeping old woman in the bulky brown and gray sweaters and black head shawl, and soon she, too, would be gone. "Gone," she grieved when he walked back in before he could even speak. "Who will take care of me now?" Yusarian ignored the question. "Natalie's girlfriend. Did anyone hear from her?" he asked. "Gone. I know she's gone, but did anyone hear from her? Does anyone know where she is?" "Gone. The little sister. What happened to her?" "Gone." The old woman's tone had not changed. "Do you know what I'm talking about?" Yusarian asked sharply, staring into her eyes to see if she were not speaking to him from a coma. He raised his voice. "What happened to the kid's sister, to the little girl?" "Gone, gone," the old woman replied with a crabby shrug, irritated by his persistence, her low wail growing louder. "Chased away with the rest, chased away into the street. They would not even let her take her coat. Where did she go? I don't know, I don't know. Who will take care of her? Who will take care of me? She doesn't know anybody else, does she? Who will take care of me?" Yusarian left money in the old woman's lap. It was odd how many wrongs leaving money seemed to right, and strode out of the apartment, cursing Catch-22 vehemently as he descended the stairs, even though he knew there was no such thing. Catch-22 did not exist. He was positive of that, but it made no difference. What did matter was that everyone thought it existed, and that was much worse, for there was no object or text to ridicule or refute, to accuse, criticize, attack, amend, hate, revile, spit at, rip to shreds, trample upon, or burn up.
No, you know, I wonder if this book is a bit of that, like this whole, everyone talks about Catch-22 without actually, there's no evidence of it. Because that would be a Catch-22. To have evidence of Catch-22 would be a Catch-22.
A law for which there is no law on the books.
And I think that that's maybe one of the undertone commentaries as well, that that's why Heller wrote it.
I mean, I guess in its most simplistic form, you can think of Catch-22 as simply a contradiction. But I think, like, everything we've seen it for, it's used either as an excuse or an allowance. It was cold outside and dark, and a leaky, insipid mist lay swollen in the air and trickled down the large, unpolished stone blocks in the houses and the pedestals of monuments. Yusarian hurried back to Milo and recanted. He said he was sorry, and knowing he was lying, promised to fly as many more missions as Colonel Cathcart wanted if Milo would only use all his influence in Rome to help him locate Natalie's kid sister. "She's just a 12-year-old virgin, Milo," he explained anxiously, "and I want to find her before it's too late." Milo responded to his request with a benign smile. "I've got just the 12-year-old virgin you're looking for," he announced jubilantly. "This 12-year-old virgin is really only 34, but she was brought up on a low-protein diet by very strict parents and didn't start sleeping with men until..." "Milo, I'm talking about a little girl," Yusarian interrupted him with desperate impatience. "Don't you understand? I don't want to sleep with her. I want to help her. You've got daughters. She's just a little kid, and she's all alone in this city with no one to take care of her. I want to protect her from harm. Don't you know what I'm talking about?" Milo did understand and was deeply touched. "Yusarian, I'm proud of you," he exclaimed with profound emotion. "I really am. You don't know how glad I am to see that everything isn't always just sex with you. You've got principles. Certainly I've got daughters, and I know exactly what you're talking about. We'll find that girl, don't you worry. You come with me, and we'll find that girl if we have to turn this whole city upside down. Come along." Yusarian went along, and Milo minded binders speeding M&M staff car to police headquarters to meet a swarthy, untidy police commissioner with a narrow black mustache and unbuttoned tunic who was fiddling with a stout woman with warts and two chins when they entered his office, and who greeted Milo with warm surprise and bowed and scraped an obscene servility as though Milo were some elegant marquis. "Ah, Marquis Milo," he declared with effusive pleasure, pushing the fat, disgruntled woman out the door without even looking toward her. "Why didn't you tell me you were coming? I would have a big party for you. Come in, Marquis. You almost never visit us anymore." Milo knew that there was not one moment to waste.
"Hello, Luigi," he said, nodding so briskly that he almost seemed rude. "Luigi, I need your help. My friend here wants to find a girl."
"A girl, Marchese," said Luigi, scratching his face pensively. "There are lots of girls in Rome. For an American officer, a girl should not be too difficult."
"No, Luigi, you don't understand. This is a 12-year-old virgin that he has to find right away."
"Ah, yes, now I understand," Luigi said sagaciously. "A virgin might take a little time, but if he waits at the bus terminal where the young farm girls looking for work arrive, I..."
"Luigi, you still don't understand."
Milo snapped with such brusque impatience that the police commissioner's face flushed and he jumped to attention and began buttoning his uniform in confusion.
"This girl is a friend, an old friend of the family, and we want to help her. She's only a child. She's all alone in the city somewhere, and we have to find her before somebody harms her. Now do you understand, Luigi? This is very important to me. I have a daughter the same age as that little girl, and nothing in the world means more to me right now than saving that poor child before it's too late. Will you help?"
"Si, Marchese, now I understand," said Luigi, "and I will do everything in my power to find her. But tonight I have almost no men. Tonight all my men are busy trying to break up the traffic in illegal tobacco."
"Illegal tobacco?" asked Milo.
"Milo," Yusarian bleated faintly with a sinking heart, sensing at once that all was lost.
"Si, Marchese," said Luigi, "the profit in illegal tobacco is so high that the smuggling is almost impossible to control."
"Is there really that much profit in illegal tobacco?" Milo inquired with keen interest, his rust-colored eyebrows arching avidly and his nostrils sniffing.
"Milo," Yusarian called him, "pay attention to me, will you?"
"Si, Marchese," Luigi answered, "the profit in illegal tobacco is very high. The smuggling is a national scandal, Marchese, truly a national disgrace."
"Is that a fact?" Milo observed with a preoccupied smile, and started toward the door as though in a spell.
"Milo!" Yusarian yelled, and bounded forward impulsively to intercept him.
"Milo, you've got to help me!"
"Illegal tobacco," Milo explained to him with a look of epileptic lust, struggling doggedly to get by.
"Let me go. I've got to smuggle illegal tobacco."
"Stay here and help me find her," pleaded Yusarian. "You can smuggle illegal tobacco tomorrow."
But Milo was deaf and kept pushing forward, non-violently but irresistibly, sweating, his eyes as though he were in the grip of a blind fixation, burning feverishly, and his twitching mouth slavering.
So I'm just looking at this and I'm going, this is beyond, like, this is a full-on extreme addiction, like...
It's like when a cartoon character gets dollar signs in their eyes.
Yeah, but this looks a lot more like it's some sort of extreme... I mean, it's a stereotype. It's a mockery, this idea of this character that's like representative of war profiteering. But in this case, it's like how they cope with the stuff that they are doing.
Mm.
It's absolutely entrenched in it. Oof.
He moaned calmly as though in remote instinctive distress and kept repeating, "Illegal tobacco, illegal tobacco." Yusarian stepped out of the way with resignation finally when he saw it was hopeless to try to reason with him. Milo was gone like a shot. The commissioner of police unbuttoned his tunic again and looked at Yusarian with contempt.
"What do you want here?" he asked coldly. "Do you want me to arrest you?"
Yusarian walked out of the office and down the stairs into the dark, tomb-like street, passing in the hall the stout woman with warts and two chins who was already on her way back in. There was no sign of Milo outside. There were no lights in any of the windows. The deserted sidewalk rose steeply and continuously for several blocks. He could see the glare of a broad avenue at the top of the long cobblestone incline. The police station was almost at the bottom. The yellow bulbs at the entrance sizzled in the dampness like wet torches. A frigid, fine rain was falling. He began walking slowly, pushing uphill. Soon he came to a quiet, cozy, inviting restaurant with red velvet drapes in the windows and a blue neon sign near the door that said, "Tony's Restaurant. Fine food and drink. Keep out." The words on the blue neon sign surprised him mildly for only an instant. Nothing warped seemed bizarre anymore in his strange, distorted surroundings. The tops of the sheer buildings slanted in weird, surrealistic perspective, and the street seemed tilted. He raised the collar of his warm woolen coat and hugged it around him. The night was raw. A boy in a thin shirt and thin tattered trousers walked out of the darkness on bare feet. The boy had black hair and needed a haircut and shoes and socks. His sickly face was pale and sad. His feet made grisly soft sucking sounds in the rain puddles on the wet pavement as he passed, and Yessarian was moved by such intense pity for his poverty that he wanted to smash his pale, sad, sickly face with his fist and knock him out of existence because he brought to mind all the pale, sad, sickly children in Italy that same night who needed haircuts and needed shoes and socks. He made Yessarian think of cripples and of cold and hungry men and women, and of all the dumb, passive, devout mothers with catatonic eyes nursing infants outdoors that same night with chilled animal udders bared insensibly to that same raw rain. Cows. Almost on cue, a nursing mother padded past holding an infant in black rags, and the Assyrian wanted to smash her too because she reminded him of the barefoot boy in the thin shirt and thin tattered trousers and of all the shivering, stupefying misery in a world that never yet had provided enough heat and food and justice for all but an ingenious and unscrupulous handful.
Hanging out with Milo is probably not helping in this case.
What a lousy earth. He wondered how many people were destitute that same night even in his own prosperous country. How many homes were shanties? How many husbands were drunk and wives socked? And how many children were bullied, abused, or abandoned? How many families hungered for food they could not afford to buy? How many hearts were broken? How many suicides would take place that same night? How many people would go insane? How many cockroaches and landlords would triumph? How many winners were losers, successes failures, rich men poor men? How many wise guys were stupid? How many happy endings were unhappy endings? How many honest men were liars, brave men cowards, loyal men traitors? How many sainted men were corrupt? How many people in positions of trust had sold their souls to blackguards for petty cash? How many had never had souls? How many straight and narrow paths were crooked paths? How many best families were worst families? And how many good people were bad people? When you added them all up and then subtracted, you might be left with only the children, and perhaps with Albert Einstein and an old violinist or a sculptor somewhere. Yessarian walked in lonely torture, feeling estranged and could not wipe from his mind the excruciating image of the barefoot boy with sickly cheeks until he turned the corner into the avenue finally and came upon an Allied soldier having convulsions on the ground. A young lieutenant with a small, pale, boyish face. Six other soldiers from different countries wrestled with different parts of him, striving to help him and hold him still. He yelped and groaned unintelligibly through clenched teeth. His eyes rolled up into his head. "Don't let him bite his tongue off," a short sergeant near Yessarian advised shrewdly, and a seventh man threw himself into the fray to wrestle with the ill lieutenant's face. All at once, the wrestlers won and turned to each other undecidedly, for now that they held the young lieutenant rigid, they did not know what to do with him. A quiver of moronic panic spread from one straining brute face to another. "Why don't you lift him up and put him on the hood of that car?" a corporal standing in back of Yessarian drawled. That seemed to make sense. So the seven men lifted the young lieutenant up and stretched him out carefully on the hood of a parked car, still pinning each struggling part of him down. Once they had him stretched out on the hood of the parked car, they stared at each other uneasily again, for they had no idea what to do with him next. "Why don't you lift him up off the hood of that car and lay him down on the ground?" drawled the same corporal behind Yessarian. That seemed like a good idea, too, and they began to move him back to the sidewalk. But before they could finish, a jeep raced up with a flashing red spotlight at the side and two military policemen in the front seat. "What's going on?" the driver yelled. "He's having convulsions," one of the men grappling with one of the young lieutenant's limbs answered. "We're holding him still." "That's good. He's under arrest." "What should we do with him?" "Keep him under arrest," the MP shouted, doubling over with raucous laughter at his jest, and sped away in his jeep. Yessarian recalled that he had no leave papers and moved prudently past the strange group toward the sound of muffled voices emanating from a distance inside the murky darkness ahead. The broad, rain-blotched boulevard was illuminated every half-block by short, curling lampposts with eerie, shimmering glares surrounded by smoky brown mist. From a window overhead, he heard an unhappy female voice pleading, "Please don't! Please don't!" A despondent young woman in a black raincoat with much black hair on her face passed with her eyes lowered. At the Ministry of Public Affairs on the next block, a drunken lady was backed up against one of the fluted Corinthian columns by a drunken young soldier, while three drunken comrades-in-arms sat washing nearby on the steps with wine bottles standing between their legs. "Please don't," begged the drunken lady. "I want to go home now. Please don't." One of the city men cursed pugnaciously and hurled a wine bottle at Yusarian when he turned to look up. The bottle shattered harmlessly far away with a brief and muted noise. Yusarian continued walking away at the same listless, unhurried pace, hands buried in his pockets. "Come on, baby," he heard the drunken soldier urge determinedly. "It's my turn now." "Please don't," begged the drunken lady. "Please don't." At the very next corner, deep inside the dense, impenetrable shadows of a narrow, winding side street, he heard the mysterious, unmistakable sound of someone shoveling snow. The measured, labored, evocative scrape of iron shovel against concrete made his flesh crawl with terror as he stepped from the curb to cross the ominous alley and hurried onward until the haunting, incongruous noise had been left behind. Now he knew where he was. Soon, if he continued without turning, he would come to the dry fountain in the middle of the boulevard, then to the officer's apartment 7 blocks beyond. He heard snarling, inhuman voices cutting through the ghostly blackness in front suddenly. The bulb on the corner lamppost had died, spilling gloom over half the street, throwing everything visible off balance. On the other side of the intersection, a man was beating a dog with a stick like the man who was beating the horse with a whip in Raskolnikov's dream. Yusarian strained helplessly not to see or hear. The dog whimpered and squealed in brute, dumbfounded hysteria at the end of an old manila rope and groveled and crawled on its belly without resisting, but the man beat it and beat it anyway with his heavy, flat stick. A small crowd watched. A squat woman stepped out and asked him please to stop. "Mind your own business," the man barked gruffly, lifting his stick as though he might beat her too, and the woman retreated sheepishly with an abject and humiliated air. Yusarian quickened his pace to get away, almost ran. The night was filled with horrors, and he thought he knew how Christ must have felt as he walked through the world, like a psychiatrist through a ward full of nuts, like a victim through a prison full of thieves. What a welcome sight a leper must have been. At the next corner, a man was beating a small boy brutally in the midst of an immobile crowd of adult spectators who made no effort to intervene. Yusarian recoiled with sickening recognition. He was certain he had witnessed that same horrible scene sometime before. Deja vu? The sinister coincidence shook him and filled him with doubt and dread. It was the same scene he had witnessed a block before, although everything in it seemed quite different. What in the world was happening? Would a squat woman step out and ask the man to please stop? Would he raise his hand to strike her, and would she retreat? Nobody moved. The child cried steadily as though in drugged misery. The man kept knocking him down with hard, resounding, open-palm blows to the head, then jerking him to his feet in order to knock him down again. No one in the sullen, cowering crowd seemed to care enough about the stunned and beaten boy to interfere. The child was no more than 9. One drab woman was weeping silently into a dirty dish towel. The boy was emaciated and needed a haircut. Bright red blood was streaming from both ears. Yusarian crossed quickly to the other side of the immense avenue to escape the nauseating sight and found himself walking on human teeth lying on the drenched, glistening pavement near splotches of blood kept sticky by the pelting raindrops, poking each one like sharp fingernails. Molars and broken incisors lay scattered everywhere. He circled on tiptoe the grotesque debris and came near a doorway containing a crying soldier holding a saturated handkerchief to his mouth, supported as he sagged by 2 other soldiers waiting in grave impatience for the military ambulance that finally came clanging up with amber fog lights on and passed them by for an altercation on the next block between a civilian Italian with boots and a slew of civilian policemen with armlocks and clubs. The screaming, struggling civilian was a dark man with a face white as flour from fear. His eyes were pulsating in hectic desperation, flapping like bat's wings, as the many tall policemen seized him by the arms and legs and lifted him up. His books were spilled on the ground, Help! He shrieked shrilly in a voice strangling in its own emotion as the policeman hurried him to the open doors in the rear of the ambulance and threw him inside. Police! Help! Police! The doors were shut and bolted, and the ambulance raced away. There was a humorless irony in the ludicrous panic of the man screaming for help to the police while policemen were all around him. Yusarian smiled wryly at the futile and ridiculous cry for aid, then saw with a start that the words were ambiguous, realized with alarm that they were not, perhaps intended as a call for police, but as a heroic warning from the grave by a doomed friend to everyone who is not a policeman with a club and a gun and a mob of other policemen with clubs and guns to back him up. Help! Police! The man had cried, and he could have been shouting of danger. Yusarian responded to the thought by slipping away stealthily from the police and almost tripped over the feet of a burly woman of 40 hastening across the intersection guiltily, darting furtive, vindictive glances behind her toward a woman of 80 with thick, bandaged ankles doddering after her in a losing pursuit. The old woman was gasping for breath as she minced along and muttering to herself in distracted agitation. There was no mistaking the nature of the scene. It was a chase. The triumphant first woman was halfway across the wide avenue before the second woman reached the curb. The nasty, small, gloating smile with which she glanced back at the laboring old woman was both wicked and apprehensive. Yusarian knew he could help the troubled old woman if she would only cry out, knew he could spring forward and capture the sturdy first woman and hold her for the mob policeman nearby if the second woman would only give him license with a shriek of distress. But the old woman passed by without even seeing him, mumbling in terrible, tragic vexation, and soon the first woman had vanished into the deepening layers of darkness, and the old woman was left standing helplessly in the center of the thoroughfare, dazed, uncertain which way to proceed, alone. Yusarian tore his eyes from her and hurried away in shame because he had done nothing to assist her. He darted furtive, guilty glances back as he fled in defeat, afraid the old woman might now start following him, and he welcomed the concealing shelter of the drizzling, drifting, lightless, nearly opaque gloom. Mobs. Mobs of policemen. Everything but England was in the hands of mobs. Mobs, mobs. Mobs with clubs were in control everywhere. The surface of the collar and shoulders of the Assyrian's coat was soaked. His socks were wet and cold. The light on the next lamppost was out, too, the glass globe broken. Buildings and featureless shapes flowed by him noiselessly, as though borne past immutably on the surface of some rank and timeless tide. A tall monk passed, his face buried entirely inside a coarse gray cowl, even the eyes hidden. Footsteps sloshed toward him steadily through a puddle, and he feared it would be another barefoot child. He brushed by a gaunt, cadaverous, trustful man in a black raincoat with a star-shaped scar in his cheek and a glossy, mutilated depression the size of an egg in one temple. On squishing straw sandals, a young woman materialized with her whole face disfigured by a god-awful pink and piebald burn that started on her neck and stretched in a raw, corrugated mass of both cheeks past her eyes. Yusarian could not bear to look, and shuddered. No one would ever love her. His spirit was sick. He longed to lay down with some girl he could love, who would soothe and excite him and put him to sleep. A mob with a club was waiting for him in Pianosa. The girls were all gone. The countess and his daughter-in-law were no longer good enough. He had grown too old for fun. He no longer had the time. Luciana was gone, dead probably, if not yet, then soon enough. Arfie's buxom trollop had vanished with her smutty cameo ring, and Nurse Duckett was ashamed of him because he had refused to fly more combat missions and would cause a scandal. The only girl he knew nearby was the plain maid in the officer's apartment, whom none of the men had ever slept with. Her name was Michaela, but the men called her filthy things in dulcet, ingratiating voices, and she giggled with childish joy because she understood no English and thought they were flattering her and making harmless jokes. Everything wild she watched them do filled her with enchanted delight. She was a happy, simple-minded, hard-working girl who could not read and was barely able to write her name. Her straight hair was the color of rotting straw. She had sallow skin and myopic eyes, and none of the men had ever slept with her because none of the men had ever wanted to, none but Arfie, who had raped her once that same evening and had then held her prisoner in a closed closet for almost 2 hours with his hand over her mouth until the civilian curfew siren sounded and it was unlawful for her to be outside. Then he threw her out the window. Her dead body was still laying on the pavement when Yusarian arrived and pushed his way politely through the circle of solemn neighbors with dim lanterns, who glared with venom as they shrank away from him and pointed up bitterly toward the second floor windows in their private, grim, accusing conversations. Yusarian's heart pounded with fright and horror at the pitiful, ominous, gory spectacle of the broken corpse. He ducked into the hallway and bolted up the stairs into the apartment, where he found Arfi pacing about uneasily with a pompous, slightly uncomfortable smile. Arfi seemed a bit unsettled as he fidgeted with his pipe and assured Yusarian that everything was going to be all right. There was nothing to worry about. "I only raped her once," he explained. Yusarian was aghast. "But you killed her, Arfi. You killed her." "Oh, I had to do that after I raped her," Arfi replied in his most condescending manner. "I couldn't very well let her go around saying bad things about us, could I?" "But why did you have to touch her at all, you dumb bastard?" Yusarian shouted. "Why couldn't you get yourself a girl off the streets if you wanted one? The city is full of prostitutes." "Oh, no, not me," Arfi bragged. "I never paid for it in my life." "Arfi, are you insane?" Yusarian was almost speechless. "You killed a girl. They're going to put you in jail." "Oh, no," Arfi answered with a forced smile. "Not me. They aren't going to put good old Arfi in jail. Not for killing her. But you threw her out the window. She's lying dead in the street." "She has no right to be there," Arfi answered. "It's after curfew." "Stupid! Don't you realize what you've done?" Yusarian wanted to grab Arfi by his well-fed caterpillar soft shoulders and shake some sense into him. "You've murdered a human being. They are going to put you in jail. They might even hang you." "Oh, I hardly think they'll do that," Arfi replied, with a jovial chuckle, although his symptoms of nervousness increased. He spilled tobacco crumbs unconsciously as his short fingers fumbled with the bowl of his pipe. "No, siree, not a good old Arfi," he chortled again. "She was only a servant girl. I hardly think they're going to make too much of a fuss over one poor Italian servant girl when so many thousands of lives are being lost every day, do you?" "Listen," Yusarian cried, almost in joy. He pricked up his ears and watched the blood drain from Arfi's face as sirens mourned far away. Police sirens, and then ascended almost instantaneously to a howling, strident, onrushing cacophony of overwhelming sound that seemed to crash into the room around them from every side. "Arfi, they're coming for you," he said in a flood of compassion, shouting to be heard above the noise. "They're coming to arrest you, Arfi. Don't you understand? You can't take the life of another human being and get away with it, even if she is just a poor servant girl. Don't you see? Can't you understand?" "Oh, no," Arfi insisted with a lame laugh and a weak smile. "They're not coming to arrest me. Not good old Arfi." All at once, he looked sick. He sank down on a chair in a trembling stupor, his stumpy, lax hands quaking in his lap. Cars skidded to a stop outside. Spotlights hit the windows immediately. Car doors slammed and police whistles screeched. Voices rose harshly. Arfi was green. He kept shaking his head mechanically with a queer, numb smile and repeating in a weak, hollow monotone that they were not coming for him, not for good old Arfi. No siree. Trying to convince himself as this was so, even as heavy footsteps raced up the stairs and pounded across the landing, even as fists beat on the door 4 times with a deafening, inexorable force. Then the door to the apartment flew open and 2 large, tough, brawny MPs with icy eyes and firm, sinewy, unsmiling jaws entered quickly, strode across the room, and arrested Yusarian. They arrested Yusarian for being in Rome without a pass. They apologized to Arfi for intruding and led Yusarian away between them, gripping him under each arm with fingers as hard as steel manacles. They said nothing at all to him on the way down. 2 more tall MPs with clubs and hard white helmets were waiting outside at a closed car. They marched Yusarian into the back seat, and the car roared away and weaved through the rain and muddy fog to a police station. The MPs locked him up for the night in a cell with 4 stone walls. At dawn, they gave him a pail for a latrine and drove him to the airport, where 2 more giant MPs with clubs and white helmets were waiting at a transport plane whose engines were already warming up when they arrived, the cylindrical green cowlings oozing quivering beads of condensation. None of the MPs said anything to each other either. They did not even nod. Yusarian had never seen such granite faces. The plane flew to Pianosa. Two more silent MPs were waiting at the landing strip. There were now eight, and they filed with precise, wordless discipline into two cars and sped on humming tires past the four squadron areas to the group headquarters building, where still two more MPs were waiting at the parking area. All 10 tall, strong, purposeful, silent men towered around him as they turned toward the entrance. Their footsteps crunched in loud unison on the cindered ground. He had an impression of accelerating haste. He was terrified. Every one of the 10 MPs seemed powerful enough to bash him to death with a single blow. They had only to press their massive, toughened, boulderous shoulders against him to crush all life from his body. There was nothing he could do to save himself. He could not even see which two were gripping him under the arms as they marched him rapidly between the two tight single-file columns they had formed. Their pace quickened, and he felt as though he were flying along with his feet off the ground as they trotted in resolute cadence up the wide marble staircase to the upper landing, where still two more inscrutable military policemen with hard faces were waiting to lead them all at an even faster pace than the long cantilevered balcony overhanging the immense lobby. Their marching footsteps on the dull tile floor thundered like an awesome, quickening drum roll through the vacant center of the building as they moved with even greater speed and precision toward Colonel Cathcart's office, and violent winds of panic began blowing in the Assyrian's ears when they turned him toward his doom inside the office, where Colonel Korn, his rump spreading comfortably on a corner of Colonel Cathcart's desk, sat waiting to greet him with a genial smile and said, "We're sending you home."
Hmm. Well, that was all awful.
That was a very awful chapter. That was difficult to read.
That was an awful chapter, and Arfi does not deserve to not be punished.
Hmm.
I don't understand how he, like, I mean, yeah, but no.
Yeah, for a brief glimmer, I thought that maybe Arfi would get comeuppance, even though I felt sympathy for him in that moment, but nope.
No, I had no sympathy. He deserved anything he got.
But I mean, nope, because they were there for Yusarian. This whole book is a farce, of course.
Yes. No, it's just absolutely not on.
And I think, you know, it's definitely for poetic license that so many awful things were happening one after another. But in a savage, war-torn city where everyone's fighting to survive, you know.
Yeah. I think also there's been a turn in the war, like there's been some sort of movement. The fact that Milo's disappeared.
To smuggle his illegal tobacco.
Well, he's disappeared suddenly. The fact that he said you should just go to Russia. And then he was like, and although Yusarian was lying, he said he was willing to go fly the missions.
To find the girl.
That would have been the smart move on the part of Milo.
Yeah, but Milo's greed got a hold of him.
Yeah, big time.
Yusarian was in such a funk just thing. You know, that bit about when he saw the young disheveled boy, about how it got him thinking about every disheveled boy.
And then generally, like, all the bad things in the world, and that if you cancelled out the good with the bad, that you only end up with, you only end up with kids, Albert Einstein, and maybe some artists.
I really like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that he pointed out the kids, and I think that's his breaking point.
Mm.
It's the kids. His breaking point has been a while ago, but he's frustrated at the innocent people who are being harmed.
There was that bit where I can't remember if it was his internal monologue or if it was just something that I think it was in his head, but the idea that, you know, basically the kid's sister has a right to blame Nate Lee's girlfriend for everything because she's older and hasn't done enough to, just like he's to blame for everything that's happening to the girl. Yeah.
He's got a bit of a sense of responsibility. And at the same time, when he was going through the streets and he felt he could have done something, but no one asked him, the old lady didn't ask him to help.
Didn't. I was thinking of Dobbs, who kept saying, just tell me, give me your blessing and I'll go kill Cathcart. And he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and I think there's a non-committal thing, but it's also a fear, because every time he has tried to do something, it hasn't ended up well.
Mm.
Like he told, when he was trying to tell, when he drew the line, he moved the line.
Mm.
And then Clevenger was dead.
Mm.
So I think he's associating his actions with that he only makes it worse unless someone asks him to do it, kind of thing. There's something messed up.
Yeah, or he just got, you know.
Well, he tried to help with Nate Lee. He went to Milo, and that made things worse.
Yes. In terms of storytelling, we always talk about active protagonist, like a main character should be willing to take chances. That's how they grow. That's how the story. But, you know, it's not that Ysirin hasn't taken action. But, yeah, as you said, every time he does, it has resulted in...
Well, catch 22. Mm. You do the thing, you do what you think is right, but it actually can make things worse.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I mean, that permeates the whole... That is the book. It's called that.
It is the book, It's absolutely it. It's, yeah, man.
It's also the name of the next chapter.
It is. I think the whole thing is just, oof.
And,
let's see. Is the next chapter the last one?
We've got three or four, depending on where, so there's either three in, like, book information, looking at my chapter marks on the Kindle here, or there's four, and the last one's very short.
Which is possible. It is an interesting, like, it's hard. It's been hard. It was hard to hear, and it would have been hard to read. So, as you mentioned, it's, oof.
It was just one example of the injustice and human, well, injustice and human suffering. One example after another of that.
He was just constant. It just was a never
ending. Like the rain.
Yeah. It was an incessant kind of, like rain, but it was just a rain of suffering.
Yeah.
Oof.
And it's also funny, he would not help that woman, yet he seemed to chastise all the onlookers in the crowd around the man beating the kid and the man beating the woman. It's like, doing anything?
Yeah. Yeah, and the kid, the soldier, allied soldier that was sapping a seizure, like all these things are just being... I don't know. I think he just went to complete passive mode.
The only thing that seemed to rouse him out was when he finally came upon the dead body that Arfi had just created.
Yeah.
Even then, it's amazing how he had, like the book says, he has compassion. He's trying to get Arfi to realize what he's done, not like out of a sense of anger or righteousness, but just, you know, to make him understand.
Yeah, you killed someone. That's not the right thing to do. You will be punished for that. Oh.
Well, you should be.
Yeah. Yeah. In his sense of justice, and again, where values are upheld, he would be punished for that. But there's no morality. There's there are no values.
Yeah, well, he did make that, Ysirin made that point again about how, oh, God. Maybe I need to find it because I don't want to misquote.
What I would like to know is, this makes me think about Arfi, you know, when him and the good old boys in the sorority used to trap kids, basically.
Yes.
Whether they had a whole bunch of possible murders there. Or if Arfi's just being sexist because and classist because she's a servant girl.
I've completely forgotten about that, but that is part of Arfi's backstory.
I would like to know what happens to Arfi,
you want to see if he faces justice.
I don't think he will, but I think there'll be some sort of scandal that when he goes back home, they'll discover he's actually a serial killer or something. Like he's, you know.
But yeah, that's the you know, the more I think of it, yeah, that's one of the most galling aspects of this book. There is no justice nowhere.
No, there's no justice at all in this
book. For anyone.
Yeah.
It's painful. So ending on this dour note.
Yes, kind of dark. But, I mean, it's interesting that we started the podcast talking about it just takes, like, one action, small actions even, giving a coat to someone if you have the option of giving someone a warm coat.
Yeah, we've talked before how game-changing a smile can be. You smile at a person.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Just... anything that we can do, anything that we the small things, I think they build up. I want to say they build up. If we have a bigger picture of what we're contributing towards, and if the bigger picture is that we want to contribute towards a world that's more just and more fair and more compassionate, but you can't do the Yossarian. And I mean, despite the fact that I think Yossarian's kind of traumatized and he was scared of getting attention of the MPs.
Yeah, that was also another weird thing, just the, yeah, that's the thing. So they come, like, the way it's set up, it looks like the MPs are coming to arrest Darfi for the murder. But they come to grab Yossarian because he doesn't have his leave form, which I find funny because he was sent to Rome by... Actually, no. Even though he was sent to Rome by Korn and Cathcart, since he went there with Milo, he probably went there covertly, so he didn't have his papers. But it's like, how did the MPs know where to find him? And then the ridiculousness of basically when he hits the airfield, there's two more, and then there's two more, there's two more. And, you know... Oh, sure, this soldier's murdered someone, but no, this guy's here without leave, so we're going to send 10 guys marching him right to...
I wonder, however, if that's also maybe an indication of Milo losing his power and control. Because Milo, the reason he's gone to Rome, yes, he's gone with Milo. Milo has the right to use the planes for shipping runs, right? And use whoever he wants. And it's because he used Yossarian... It's a bit weird. I'm wondering if things will clear up in the next couple of chapters, but...
Well, even though the whole chapter was very dour, it did end on that line where they're sending him home.
You know what it is? Another thing I'm thinking? Milo, so far, remember he's only really dealt with legal goods. Technically what he's done is legal. But he suddenly went, ooh, illegal tobacco.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the straw that broke the syndicate's back.
I mean that's one of the sad jokes of capitalism, just how much is actually legal, no matter how terrible it is. What I said before, the whole chapter though ends with Korn saying, we're sending you home.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens because nothing about this seems right.
Well, also that this upcoming chapter is called Catch 22. There's definitely going to be some strings attached to that.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes, but my gosh.
Yeah, well, you know, folks, thanks for sticking with us. I know this chapter was a hard one. Believe me, having to read through it, yeah. I can sympathize. But we thank you for joining us. We hope you did enjoy it. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo. And you can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Twitter, on Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you get our email. And we welcome your correspondence. Please let us know if you have any feedback, any thoughts, any books that you think are really would be maybe a good read or you'd like to hear our responses to. And if you are using any podcast listing option where we are available that gives you the review settings that lets you leave a review, we welcome your reviews. Of course, if you write us an email or tag us on a post that's interesting on Twitter, we're also very excited about those things. Thank you.
So until next time, please stay safe, enjoy your reading, and we'll see you soon. We'll be right back.